Okay. Okay, so we are on. Chapter 2, the fourth verse. Okay? Let's chant it. Pratibodhaviritam-matam.
Pratibodhaviritam-matam.
Amritattvam hi vindate.
Amritattvam hi vindate.
Atmana vindate viryam.
Atmana vindate viryam.
Vidyaya vindate mritam.
Vidyaya vindate mritam.
Okay, so pratibodha viritam matam. Pratibodha, we take bodha as a cognition. Okay? Any cognition. So in a way, it just means a vritti. So pratibodha means every cognition. Pratibodha viritam is that which is there, that which is known in every cognition. So really beautiful, because every cognition, every vritti that you have is actually different, right? Because using your sense organs, like if you're using your eyes, if I look over here, that's one cognition, the content of the cognition, the object of the cognition, could just be this wall, etc., whatever I'm looking at right here. I'm looking here, this is the object of the cognition. It changes. I look down here, changes continually. The cognitions continually change faster than you can even imagine, really. Because you're blinking, there's a different cognition. So the cognitions are continually changing very rapidly. But that which is known in every cognition, viditam is what is known. It's past passive participle. Viditam, that which is known in every cognition. So if you say like this, pratibodha, bodha stands for cognition, prati, every cognition, pratibodha viditam, that which is known in every cognition, matam. So here I have to say, Brahman is known as that which is known in every cognition. That's how Brahman is known, because matam, that which is known, we're talking Brahman is known. How is Brahman known? How is Brahman recognized? It is recognized as that which is known in every cognition. The beautiful thing about that is that there's no distance in any given cognition. Cognition means any vritti. There's no distance between the vritti and consciousness. There's no distance between the vritti and me. Right? I consider, because of ajnanam actually, I take myself in every cognition to be the knower of that cognition. The knower means, the only reason I take myself to be the knower, because you don't really experience that, you just experience the known cognition. That's your actually your experience. You don't experience a knower of the cognition. But because I don't take myself to be the object of the cognition, then I identify with the consciousness, the sat-chit that is there pervading every single cognition as me. And so me as the conscious being becomes the one because of whom the cognition is known. The object of the vritti is known. See that? So what do I call that one because of whom the object of the cognition is known? In English, how do I call that? See, I am the knower of the known. The cognition is known. I'm the one because of whom it is known. I am the knower of the cognition. And then that gives me That lets me, this body, mind, sense organs, identify with a consciousness which is the invariable in every cognition. Why? Because every cognition is known. You can't have a vritti that's not known. And so even though the vrittis are continually changing, the invariable is the knownness which every single vritti enjoys. That knownness is consciousness. And so consciousness is, I don't walk around labeling myself as consciousness. I walk around labeling myself as me. But the me that I'm labeling is the conscious being, the me, the conscious being, that because of ajnanam has totally identified this conscious being that we call me with the body-mind-sense organs. That identification is there because the body-mind-sense organs enjoy consciousness. Because of the sattva, the sukshma sharira, the sense organs in the mind, consciousness pervades this body, right? And so why shouldn't the body-mind-sense organs take itself to be me? Why? Why should it take itself to me? Because I am consciousness, right? And if this body enjoys consciousness, I am consciousness in the sense that I am a conscious being, I'm certainly not an inert being. And so this superimposition naturally takes place in until my own nature is differentiated from these very natural superimpositions. Another thing that I feel is so important to understand here is that yourself is not ignorant. There's no ignorance from the standpoint of the self. It's just like I could say in this way, using an illustration, a drishtanta, is that say the bright sun, right, the sun in the sky, is illumining the clouds. It illumines the clouds. It's not covered by the clouds, right? It illumines the clouds. So on a very, very cloudy day, the sun is lighting that up from its own perspective, you know. But from somebody on the ground or on the other side of the clouds, for that person, the clouds become like some sort of big, huge ajnanavritti. You know, just this massive ignorance shield that is stopping me from appreciating the very nature of the sun. Even though I can say the sun is lighting up the clouds, but you know, I would like to experience the sun itself. I don't get to experience the sun when the clouds are there, says the person on the ground, right? So that this drishtanta is actually really a good one, because from the standpoint of the self, the clouds are not an obstruction at all. I am the conscious being, doing absolutely nothing as the stocking as the sun. I am the self-evident shining sun, which is doing nothing other than just being myself, and myself being a luminous globe, orb, allows the clouds to be illumined. Not because of anything it's doing, just because of what it is. And so from the standpoint of the sun, the clouds aren't an obstacle at all. They're just what happens to be illumined for no reason at all by me, by the sun. What I mean by for no reason at all, there is a reason. I mean, the clouds have moved into the orb of the sun from the standpoint of the one standing on the ground. So that's the reason. But from the standpoint of the sun, there's no reason at all. And even from the standpoint of the sun, you can't say the sun is a knower. It's just a luminous orb, right? It doesn't have any idea what is being illumined in its wake. All it is the luminous orb. I'm kind of like that, you know, except there's no distance between me, the consciousness, and the vrittis that are passing through, whereas the sun is way up there, then there's the clouds, and then there's the person standing on the ground. So there's a lot of space between the sun, you know, the clouds, and then the person on the ground. For me, there is no space at all between me and the things that are illumined, right? What is illumined, actually, is just simply the vritti. But from my standpoint, not only do I have no ignorance, from my standpoint, there is nothing there but me, right? There's nothing there that me. Why? Why would we say such a thing? Well, because from my standpoint, the standpoint of just me, conscious being, there are no sense organs. The sense organs are illumined, right? I don't have sense organs. Consciousness doesn't have sense organs. Consciousness, me, is only me. This me, this consciousness, because of the of the vicinity of the sense organs as mitya, you know, they have no distance from me, but it is the sense organs that bring about vrittis, not consciousness. Consciousness just simply illumines the vrittis and illumines the vrittis, illumines the mind, which then utilizes the sense organs, passing on that consciousness in order to form a vritti. And that vritti is known. Not because somebody is knowing it, but because the vritti takes place in consciousness. It is mitya. The vritti being mitya means it has no consciousness of its own. It has no being of its own. That's why it can come into being. Now it is and it is known, and it can go out of being. What does that mean? It means it doesn't carry conscious being with it, you know? Just imagine what that would mean. If you have this flow of vrittis, and each one has its own conscious being that it carries along with it, what would that be like? Here now, here this conscious being has come. It's like a guest has come. A guest that has its own conscious being, and you have conscious being. And so we have my conscious being meeting the conscious being in the form of the vritti. That's not what happens at all. That would be very strange. That would be a very strange experience, but that is not our experience. Our experience is that vritti by vritti by vritti comes into conscious being and goes out of conscious being. The only thing that doesn't come into conscious being and go out of conscious being is conscious being, right? That conscious being is me. I am the invariable. But now say this invariable is a knower, right? It's a knower. And then this invariable is going to, which is a knower, is going to have a relationship with the known. It's called the knower-known relationship, right? For there to be, you have to just settle down and kind of think about this quietly. For there to be a knower-known relationship requires what we call a sambandha. Sambandha means a relationship. There is no possibility of having a relationship between two orders of reality. Mitya is one order of reality. When we say something is mitya, we analyze, and that's why it's so important to really, we have to analyze this creation, we have to analyze Ishvara, to see that as we analyze it, we realize that all of our perceptions, all of the things that we know, including the knower-known relationship itself, is a different order of reality because you can actually analyze the whole thing away. Without very much trouble. You can analyze it away. Remember I said basically in three ways. One is you can analyze it away in terms of time. Because anything that comes into being and goes out of being can't have any being of its own. There is nothing in the creation that doesn't come into being and go out of being. Come into manifestation and go into unmanifestation. Actually be born and die. You know, that means that these things that we experience are bordered by non-being, and so we have to then do an analysis going into the object itself while it's here and see if we can find anything here that has any type of lasting substance. And so realizing that it has non-existence on either side, and that should just negate the whole thing right away because nothing can come from non-being and go into non-being. So that actually should be enough for us. With that understanding, we have to say that this object, this experience, that what we're experiencing, it has on the surface no being of its own. You know? And we have beautiful drishtantas for that, our good old wood desk. You know, on the surface, we can say, just looking at that desk, we can say the nama-rupa, the name and form desk, it has no being of its own. Right? The shape, desk shape, it has no being of its own. The only thing really there is wood. Right? So wood is what is there. There is no desk. There's only wood. But we say the wood is, we don't say the desk is non-existent, right? Because we experience it. But when we analyze it, then the story changes a little bit. Yes, we experience the desk, but the only thing there is wood. Everybody says, yeah, that's true. That's true. We could do it with a pot. We experience the pot, but really the only thing there is clay. Yeah, that's true. And so we actually, when we say that, we have the desk and the pot, there are two orders of reality. The one order we call mithya, because that pot is really not there. The only thing there is clay, right? The only thing there is clay. But we experience the pot. And so we don't say there is no pot. We experience the pot. If there was no pot, zero, to be experienced, then we'd say there is no pot, right? Because we don't experience a pot. That's like saying when, if we say the horn of a rabbit. Somebody show me a horn of a rabbit and then I'll believe there's a horn of a rabbit. But we're assuming that there is no such thing as a horn of a rabbit. And that means that's what we call tucham. You cannot experience it because it's truly not there. Well, now if you say clay pot and I say there really is only clay there, what will you say? I know, but I experience the pot. If you say, you know, this is a desk, but there really is no desk. Yeah, but I experience the desk. You don't experience the horn of the rabbit, right? That means it's absolute non-existence. So now, say, understanding this is what we mean by mithya. You have to analyze this whole creation and say, you know, I experience it, but does it have, what is it dependent on for its being? What is it dependent on for its knownness, you know? And if you can, if you can say, well, you know, it is being itself. It's not dependent on anything for its being. It is self-evident. It is a self-evident desk. It is the only desk in the world. I'm kidding. It's the only desk in the world that is and is self-evident. And then you can say, then I would say, well, does that desk, you know, does that desk really exist itself? And then you would say, well, I don't really understand what you mean by that. I said, well, what's making the thing a desk is really only wood. The only thing really there is wood. You say, I know, that's obvious. The only thing really there is wood. That's true. And so then what is the relationship of the desk to the wood? Well, I don't know. What words do you have for that? Well, the words we have for that is the desk is one order of reality that we call mithya. The wood is another order of reality that we call satyam. The wood is what is actually there. The desk is experienced but has no being apart from the wood at all. So this satyam mithya is so important for us to understand in analyzing the universe, because otherwise this universe is away from me. This universe, and I'll see that this universe has its own independent being. And if it has its own independent being, then this pratyagatma, this innermost conscious being that is me, is different from this universe that I experience because it has its own being. So the Vedantin takes all this very seriously, because if you think this universe is separate from you, then we don't have a Dvaita anymore. It's not that this universe comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. It's certainly not that my being is the very self, the very adhishtana of the whole universe. No, I'm just this Atma, and the universe is something else. That's Dvaita. That's not the vision of the Shastra. That is not the vision at all of the Upanishads. That's not when we say Ishvara, that's not what we mean at all. When we say Ishvara, what we mean is that Brahman, which is the conscious being, which is me, is the very Adhishtana, is the very me of the entire universe. I am the bottom line. So let's just think about this for a minute, because we need to be able to actually recognize that with your eyes open, looking at this room, having a vritti of this room, that the substance of the very vritti that you're having is the self. The self is the adhishtana of the vritti. This has to be recognizable. And what makes it tricky is we can't recognize myself as an object. So then we say, well, if you can't recognize yourself as an object, which this whole Upanishad is about, we can't recognize me or Brahman or conscious being as an object, then how on earth can it be known? We have to be so careful with the language. So what here in this first line, what he says is, let me say this first. Every experience that you have of this world, including all the analysis that we do, this is satya mitya, the desk is mitya, the wood is satyam, relatively speaking, you know. All of these are vrittis, right? All of our analysis is vritti after vritti after vritti. In order for us to recognize that this world, as we break it down, has no independent being. That's a major task for us, is to realize beyond any doubt that this world that we experience has in the end, for its adhishtana, for its substance, only Brahman. Only Brahman. So starting with the desk, you go to the wood as the satyam of the mithya desk. But now you go to the wood. What is the wood? Is the wood satyam? Is the wood self-evident? Is the wood itself existent? Is it self-shining? Is it existence itself? Or does the wood come into being and go out of being? That's a problem. Because if the wood, which is the satyam of the mithya desk, itself comes into being and goes out of being, then that wood itself is mithya. And it must depend upon something else. Right? And this type of dependency, in a sense, will go into an infinite regress, not for the best of reasons, but for a very logical reason, and that is, you can only see what has name and form. You can only experience this world with your sense organs that have name and form. And we don't think, until the Upanishad comes along, to include ourselves, the self, in this satya-mitya, you know, relationship. And so until we can include that which is pure existence and self-evident in the satya-mitya relationship, we will always go into some sort of an infinite regress. Once we're looking at one object and we say, okay, is this object dependent upon anything, or are all things dependent upon it? We'll say, no, it has to be dependent on something because it comes into being and goes out of being. And so therefore, there's something existent that it must be dependent on, because since it's subject to change, it has no real being of its own. And so we can analyze and take everything apart and take it apart into smaller and smaller pieces, but we still have this problem that either that object that has now become satyam, as we work our way down into the actual content of something, we have two problems. Either that content comes into being itself and goes out of being, just lasts a little longer than the previous content, so that makes it mitya. Or another problem is that this thing that we think is the final being, you know, is divisible into smaller beings. This form is the final form. Yeah? But the problem is, if that form takes up space, it's divisible. Any form, if it takes up space, cut it, divisible. Even if you get down to atoms and quarks, cut it up, divisible. That means it's a conglomerate, not a thing. conglomerate is mithya. Right? It's mithya. Because it's not a thing. You think it's a thing. It's not a thing. We have to find the thing, and then we'll analyze the thing and see if the thing is, you know, actually exists. But within Maya, within time and space, there is no thing. Because as long as anything, any vastu, and vastu means a thing, any vastu that takes up space is divisible, you know. I think I told the story maybe in Mangalam this last time, I think, or before. I had one student who was actually a scientist, and he was a student of Swamiji's, Pooja Swamiji. He used to come to my classes, and then Swamiji would come, and it would be wonderful. But he got a hold of this idea in his mind of mithya, you know, and the fact that he wanted to scientifically find the smallest moment. If he could just find, even in terms of time, you know, the problem with time, again, is that it's infinitely divisible. So say you have a moment, and then he would actually have instruments that would take pictures, very sophisticated instruments that would take pictures of smaller and smaller moments. And so he would take these snapshots, trying to capture, ultimately, the moment, a moment. Swamiji just used to use a very simple drishtanta to show the problem. But when Kai, his name was Kai, when Kai got a hold of Swamiji's simple example, he really wanted to go test it with all these instruments. Swamiji's simple example was that if you hold, you know, 500 rose petals. When they do a puja, they often have, you know, a big basket of petals. So pick up 500 petals and put them together and hold them like that. So now there's 500 petals. And now take just a needle, because we had string these malas, you know, take your needle and just put it through. That, putting it through would probably take less than a second because the petals are so soft, so through. Now we have actually, if you were to take a picture of that and put it in slow motion, you would see that needle going through each petal, one at a time. So now that moment is now 500 moments. So Kai thought, you know, what is the smallest moment that can be measured? And so he had these sophisticated machines, even showed us the machines. So he did a lot of, you know, studies and experiments on this. And you know what happened? He could never find the smallest moment. He went into milliseconds of milliseconds of milliseconds, unimaginably small things. But through this device that he had, there would be a wiggle in that moment, even though that moment was unimaginably small. Because it doesn't matter. This is the thing to understand. It does not matter how small it is. If it comes, it can be absolutely microscopic, more than microscopic, like a nano moment, okay? Unimaginable. But, you know, if that nano moment takes up time, even the very smallest amount of time, that nano moment is bordered by non-existence. That moment comes and goes, like all moments. You could have what you think is a moment turns out to be a giant moment. It might as well be lasting for a whole year, depending, you know, in reference to the nano moment. But whether it's your concept of a moment, it comes and goes. What if it's a nano moment? It comes and goes. If it comes and goes, it's mithya. And it is impossible to find. So this is something to contemplate on, because it's a fact, actually. It's impossible to find a moment within time as long as the moment takes up time. It doesn't make any difference at all how little or more, or how much time it takes up. If it takes up time, it's indivisible. It's divisible. What if a moment doesn't take up time? It's not a moment. If it doesn't take up time, how can you even know about it? And so here, when Swamiji will do this kind of elaborate, just kind of like I'm doing now, kind of this elaborate analysis of our experience within time. So let's look at it this way, and this is how it very beautifully resolves, actually. Time we can call as past, present, and future, right? And so our experience of a moment is our experience of the present. But the present takes place in terms of our experience kind of in the flow of time. So past, present, future, like that. It keeps moving like this. But the fact is that we are always in the present, right? You can't have an experience of the past. You would have to draw a memory of the past into the present, and then that memory would be taking place in the present, right? So you have never, ever, ever been outside of the present. You can imagine the future, but only in the present. You can remember the past, but only in the present. The present is impossible to find because it's infinitely divisible. And so then, even though that's true, it is infinitely divisible, and so you can really not really experience the present, and yet you are never out of the present. So Swamiji will say so beautifully, you are the presence of the present. You are the presence of the present. Within this samsara, within this creation that we experience, there is an as though flow of time, but not for you. Not for you. You are the eternal presence. For you, there is no flow of time. All you ever experience is the presence. It is the present, but you must be the presence of the present. You are the present in the form of the presence, the timeless presence of the present. But as we try to find the present within this infinitely divisible world, this infinitely divisible experience that we're having of the creation, that present is not something you can find. And yet, there is nothing that takes place outside of the present. But the only thing that is the present is yourself. And that self, that's the Atma, that self is timeless. And that timeless self exists. I exist. But if this me, that is not, this me, which is actually not objectifiable, thank goodness, because if it were objectifiable, then it's bound by this infinite regress, trying to find a moment which you can't do, trying to find an object which you can't do, because they're all conglomerates. And the whole universe itself coming into being and going out of being. Every single object comes into being, goes out of being, comes into being, goes out. It has no existence of its own. It can't go out. It can't come from nothing and go into nothing and have any being of its own. It's not possible. It can't be something that doesn't exist. A conglomerate is not a thing, you know. So we stuck all of these things together, all of these different objects together, as Buddha will say, now we have a chariot, you know. But then you have to take the chariot apart and say, well, it's not really a chariot, it's just a bunch of names for different things, and we put one giant name on it called chariot. And that's like everything here. Look at this body, look at your body. How many things are involved? How many parts are involved to this body, in this body, you know? And we think of it as just me. The Buddha, that's why the Buddha does a lot of really good things in terms of neti neti, not this, not this. Are you your little finger? Is that you? What? Are you your little finger? Okay, you're your little finger. Yes, I'm my little finger. Are you your knee? Yeah, I'm my knee too. What is the relationship between, is there two me's? Is there the knee me and the little finger me? Really? Is there the brain me There's the brain me, and then the heart me, and then the liver me. What do I say? You know, there's only one me. There's only one me. But I can't be divided up like that if there's only one me. I can't be divided up into all of these parts. It's not possible, because then there would be a whole bunch of little me's, you know, like cells as they divide. Then there's a whole bunch of little cells. So there'd be a whole bunch of little me's. There's not a whole bunch of little me's. There's only one me. And then we have the other problem. This body, mind, sense organs, it's something that is known. Right? It is known. And I take myself to be, you know, the conscious being that indwells this body, I can say. And that this body is known, this body exists, and it is known. But sometimes it's not known, and sometimes it doesn't exist. A dead body doesn't exist. If I'm thinking about something else, then I have no perception of this body, so it's not even there. So we have these issues that have to be resolved. I have to start to recognize that this world that seems so real, and it is real compared to the dream, you know, it has a longer lasting reality than the dream. And also my dream is subjective. Within my dream, the characters in the dream, you know, all are existing in their own order of reality. And so they're enjoying a shared reality within the order of reality of the dream itself. They have a shared reality. We have a shared reality within this world, right? Bhagawan gave us the dream. Because I know very clearly that that dream depends upon me for its being. It's very clear. If I were a person in the dream, that would not be clear. Right? If I were a person in the dream, then I would be experiencing this dream with my eyes and ears and my mind, and I would be working the dream with my body, my organs, my hands and my feet. I would be participating, I would be part of that dream. That dream would be so completely real. But not from my standpoint. From my standpoint, that dream comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. If I analyze any given part of the dream, I see very clearly it is mithya. It has no independent being. That's so simple for me to see. But it would not be simple for the dream character. And we are the dream characters in this world. And so it takes quite a bit of analysis for me to understand, really, without any doubt, that this world, including my body and my mind and my sense organs, are mithya. For many, many different, very solid, logical reasons, they borrow existence, but they don't have existence for themselves, because they come into being and go out of being, because you can't find any type of vastu or any type of thing here on analysis. It goes in, everything goes into infinite regress. You can't even find a moment here. There is no such thing as a moment. You're the moment. You're the presence of the present, but you can't find the present.
No.
And so we have to do all of this to then really understand that this pratibodhitam viditam matam, that to understand what Brahman is, how to say it, you know. Brahman's not some non-dual thing out there. Brahman is the Brahman is known as what? As the consciousness, as that which is known, literally viditam, in every cognition. The knownness in every cognition is Brahman. The sat chit in every cognition. You cannot have a cognition that does not exist and does not enjoy consciousness. That is not possible. Consciousness, existence, conscious being, right, is not something that you can see either. You can only be that. You can't objectify it, and you don't need to objectify it. It is because of me, because of conscious being, which is the presence of the present, which is the presence of every vritti that passes through. So I'm always the present. I have no worries about that. I mean, just think about this. Say if you weren't the timeless present, okay? No such thing as a timeless present. The past is gone. Right now, the past is gone. I can't even say it fast enough. Past is gone. Okay. Past is gone, okay. Present has come. Where are you in that? Where are you in that? If there isn't a present, if there isn't really a present that we have to call the presence, what would this be? Everything is gone before you even before you even blink. Everything's gone before you blink. We would be insane. I mean, what could we do? We wouldn't know anything. We wouldn't know anything because there's nothing hanging things together. But the fact is that this infinitely quick, a change which you can't even measure. You can't measure the smallest moment. It's impossible, and that's what Kai was trying to do. Let me find that moment. He could not find it. With all of his equipment, he could not find that moment. That nanosecond is gone. Before you finish saying it takes way too long to say nanosecond. It's so gone. So what would your experience be then? But you know what? We don't have any problem at all. Because the present is what is. The present is Brahman. I am the present. I am the changeless present, and all of this stuff is going like crazy in me, but I am the self of the whole thing that holds the whole thing together. It makes no difference how fast these things are moving or how slow they're moving, how long they live, what a short little period of time they live. It makes no difference at all because these things have no being apart from me. I am their truth. I am what is actually here, and I am timeless. So there's no movement at all. So all of this mitya hangs together very, very well. But why does it hang together very, very well? Because it has no substance whatsoever. You have no fear of these things that are continually coming and going faster than you could even imagine. Because the truth of them is not coming and going. It's the same thing when you wake up from a dream and the whole thing just evaporates. The whole thing evaporates like that. But nothing has happened at all. Nothing has happened. And we can kind of smilingly say that, but we smilingly say it because it's so amazing. Nothing has happened because nothing has happened. Because for mitya is not really there. It's only we experience it. That's why we say, we experience and therefore we have to have a category of reality for it. But upon analysis, you simply can't find it. You might as well say, no, it's not there. The only thing, clay pot, only thing there is clay. Wood desk, only thing there is wood. Entire creation, the only thing there is Brahman. But here we are. And it all is fine because of my stability. The stability of myself, of the self. The changelessness, the timelessness of just my simple presence. So Brahman is that one who is shining, self-evident Brahman that is shining as the very knownness, the very consciousness in every single vritti. Billions of them are coming and going. But Brahman just remains as that stable conscious being, which is the Adhishtana, which is the actual self of all of these things coming and going. Brahman is just me, simply there. So now it says, in the second pada of this, it says, Amritatvam hi vindate. Because Brahman is that constant, I gain vindate through knowledge. I gain by that knowledge itself, Amritatvam. I gain freedom from death. I gain freedom from change. For amrita, mrita means dead. So mrita means anything that changes, comes into being and goes out of being. Vindate, recognizing with this knowledge, recognizing Brahman and mitya, satyam mitya, recognizing that, I recognize myself, me, as free from any change. And so I become free from death. I am the one who is there, the constant, the invariable, who no matter what the vritti is, it could be in the form of emotion, what the emotion is. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I can do inner child work and all of these things within this relative reality. But for me, I am absolutely free of that. All of this comes and goes and comes and goes. It is mithya. It has no being at all. It has no consciousness. I am the consciousness. I am the conscious being. So nothing out here is really happening. Not really. But then this body isn't really here either. You know? It's here. It's here. This mind is here. These emotions are here. These sambandhas, these relationships are here. These different gunas are here. All of us are here. We are here. But really, really, this experience that we're sharing, as relatively real as it is, has only one adhishtana. And that adhishtana, conscious being, is what, from its own standpoint, blesses, gives life, gives consciousness, existence to this whole thing. So I actually, this simple me that is there in every vritti I have, is the simple me, the very personal simple me, that is there in every vritti you have. It is there as the very simple me for Ishvara. It's the very simple me for all living creatures. It's the very simple me for the rock and for the lamp. There's only one me. There can't be many me's. If there are many me's, then they're all mitya. Because they exist within time and space, and they must, as the rest of everything within the creation, come into being and go out of being. So they don't have no being of their own. And so since we experience them, and they say, this is known, they have to depend on something in order for them to have actual being. For me to have being, what do I depend on? This body dies, these sense organs are going, you know, the whole thing is going to go, you know. One thought comes, another thought comes, another thought comes, or everything about you is coming and going. No problem for me, though, you know, comes and goes, no problem, because I don't come and go. I never come and go, I never change in any way. It's just a fact. Just recognize yourself. In every single vritti, every one of them comes and goes. You don't. You are the one who is present, who is stable. You couldn't be more stable. And recognizing yourself like that, you become amritattvam. You gain the status of amritattvam, meaning you become free of death, which you have always been free of death. You are free of change. You just simply are the Satchitatman. That's it. That's what you are. Now, he says, how do you become one who is able to know that? How do you gain that capacity? Next class.
Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.